91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. On May 9th, 36 years ago, disaster struck in Tampa Bay. A freighter ship plowed into a support pier of the massive Skyway Bridge. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. 35 lives were lost in the catastrophe, which mirrored a perfect storm. The event was horrific enough on its own, but continued to haunt the Tampa Bay community, as well as the vilified individual on the ship's helm and the collapse survivors. The Florida Department of Transportation had given dire warnings of the landmark bridge's condition. We'll speak with journalist Bill DeYoung, who wrote Skyway, the true story of Tampa Bay's signature bridge and the man who brought it down. Topical Currents up next. First, the news.
And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you. So this hour, we reflect on a Florida disaster which occurred in 1980. It's an event which fed on a chain of mishaps and unusual weather. 35 people were killed when one half of the famed landmark Skyway Bridge over Tampa Bay was destroyed.
A 20,000-ton, 606-foot freighter hit a bridge support during a torrential rainstorm. The harbor pilot of the Summit Venture ship was unfairly vilified for the tragedy. Before the bridge toppled, warnings of its weakened structural condition had been given.
With us now is editor and journalist Bill DeYoung. He's the author of the book Skyway, the True Story of Tampa Bay's Signature Bridge and the Man Who Brought It Down.
And good afternoon.
And Bill DeYoung joins us from Tampa Public Station, WUSF. We always have to credit your home public radio station.
Oh, yeah.
Bill.
Yeah.
Welcome, Bill.
Hey, thank you so much for having us here. It's I wish it was a happier occasion, but here we are.
That's true. Yeah. You're from St. Pete. I thought we'd begin with your earliest memories of the Skyway Bridge. You were so young. What was your experience? What did it mean to you as a child?
Terror, abject terror. That bridge was so high and so steep and was just literally out there. When you're a kid, it seemed like you were just crossing the ocean with nothing on either side of you. And I think if you talk to anybody who lived here during that period, the 50s, 60s, into the 70s, their memories are very similar. It was always kind of a dicey proposition. It swayed in the wind when you were up in the top. It's very scary.
I remember driving that in the early to mid-70s and just wanting to get over it, because going up it was so steep, you felt like if my engine cuts out, I'm going to just have to brake to keep from rolling backwards at an incredible speed. And you just wanted to get over it. In fact, in the book, you say that it was like a 10-degree angle. It seemed much more than that.
It was a 5-degree angle, actually.
Yeah, that,
but it's starting from a horizontal place. It's actually fairly steep.
It seemed like it was so much steeper than 5 degrees.
This is what the records say. You know, I'm not a mathematician or a physicist, but that's what they tell me. I thought it was too. I always thought it was like going up a roller coaster. You know, just sort of ching, 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 ching.
Yeah, if you would hold a protractor on the horizon in the picture, that thing would be like a 25 degrees, I think.
Oh, it's so interesting, too, Joseph, when you look at photographs, depending on the angle from which they were shot, sometimes it does look steep like a mountain. Other times it looks very gradual. You know, there's a trick of the eye involved there. It's for someone smarter than me to figure out. It was very steep, yeah.
Well, I wanted to tell you that, of course, I learned about this while reading the book, but how strange it was for me when I realized that I knew nothing about this. Now, I was living in New York at the time, but you would think that a disaster of this magnitude would have captured worldwide attention, but it didn't. Why?
Well, I can tell you very simply, the sensationalist aspect of it, you know, came and went, and within 2 weeks, Mount St. Helens erupted out in Washington State. There goes your national headlines. The bridge thing went back, as they say in my favorite movie, Jaws, back where the grocery ads are in the back of the newspaper. So a lot of people remember John Laro, the pilot, his vilification, but they don't remember that he was exonerated because it wasn't big national news anymore.
And over on this side of Florida, we had the Mariel boat lift going on and also the Miami riots.
Liberty City, it was crazy. It was a very bad year for Florida. And it didn't take much for this to become, to go back to being regional than a local event.
You know, Bill, you mentioned that you wanted to write about this, and you wrote the book in 2013, correct?
Well, it came out in 2013. I started in 2009. And interestingly, my wife and I were living in Savannah, Georgia at the time. We wrote the whole book in Georgia. Was down here a lot doing research, obviously.
Right.
But I was from here. I knew the area. I was very familiar with the story, and I just wanted to find out more. I wasn't finding out through reading what I wanted to find out about it. I was very interested in the human side, how these people who had survived and their families and their friends, how the people who had survived lived with it. How do you go on with this in your mind? And I found out lots of interesting things.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things is you said none of the accounts that you had read jived, and you wanted to find out the truth. And just as a coincidence, our engineer today, Michael Stock, one of our colleagues here, he said, oh, I was at, the radio station and at WUSF in 1980 when this happened. He said it was that guy that it was a rainstorm and he plowed it into the bridge. And I was thinking, That's exactly what you're talking about, that either he was drunk or all these incompetent descriptions or illustrations of what had actually happened.
Exactly. I was speaking at the main library in St. Petersburg the day before yesterday because it's the anniversary and there's obviously a lot of attention focused on this. And one of the things that comes up in the PowerPoint that I do is I say, well, people still say to me, you ask my wife, I talk about this way too much, but so I'm always in discussion with somebody about it. People still say, oh, yeah, he was drunk, wasn't he? Mm. Well, the truth was that John did not drink. He was a teetotaler. His favorite beverage was orange soda. And that goes on. He had been a ballet dancer in New York. Well, that cast all sorts of things. It was 1980, don't forget.
Right.
Sort of aspersions on his sexuality and things like that. He was married with a young son. A lot of those things just remain, and it wasn't so much that I was kept reading and kept finding about. There were just little discrepancies in the way things were described. I'll give you an example. Wesley McIntyre, with whom you're familiar, who is the sole survivor, I remember reading it many times, his pickup truck bounced off the deck and rolled off the side. Well, that's kind of cool, But then when I met his wife, and I started reading the interviews that Wes had given, it turned out he flew off the edge of the bridge and slammed into the side of the hull, ricocheted off, and sank to the bottom. Mm. That's different. And I thought, well, I'm finding things like that. And it was written differently everywhere.
And he had
What else isn't right?
He had been a Navy diver or something, so he was able to hold his breath and come up to the surface.
He was a swimmer. His daughter told me that her parents lived in Gulfport, which is right here on the edge of Tampa Bay, and he was a swimmer. He still practiced all the time. He could hold his breath a really long time and was a great swimmer. And perhaps that's the only reason he was able to get out of his car and make it all the way up. Very sad story, though.
Well, before we get to the actual event, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the bridge itself, the channel, the physical bridge, what the Skyway Bridge meant, what its presence was, and talk about the nature of Tampa Bay, the depths, the channels, any other important factors.
Well, Tampa Bay obviously is how you get to the Port of Tampa. In its most simple form, that's what's true. To get to the Port of Tampa, which was at the time the seventh busiest port in the United States, you have to go through South Tampa Bay, which means it's a big open body of water. And they started talking about building a bridge over to the South counties and the other side of the bay in the 20s. When eventually World War II came in, the money ran out. You used to have to take a ferry across the bay. So what happens is the powers that be decide, well, let's go ahead. Let's first, it was going to be a tunnel. You can't build tunnels in Florida, not with this water table. So let's build a bridge crossing 15 miles of open bay, and this will bring more people to Manatee County and Sarasota County and all the way down to Fort Myers and down this coast here. Money. It's really all about money and tourism. It was a 45-minute detour to go through Tampa to get to the South Counties from here. It always kind of bugged me that not many people, there were a few dissenting voices, but not many people said, you know, is it really smart to build a bridge that goes over the busiest shipping channel in this part of the country? Mm-hmm. And that's a busy channel. And it went up 150 feet, as you know, over the over the bay. Tampa Bay is on an average 12 to 13 feet deep. So it's very important. The mandatory rule about harbor pilots that's in effect all over the country is very important here, because you get somebody who's local and knows these channels. It's a spider web of channels getting you into the port of Tampa. You have to hire somebody local to get aboard your ship when you're coming in and get you there without grounding, because if you go little bit outside of the channel, you're grounded. Mm-hmm. And that's in effect at every port in the country that has ships over a certain tonnage. But it was especially important here because people from China, Japan, from India, from the Mediterranean, these guys, they're all over the world. They don't know what Tampa Bay is like. You can read it on a map, but you're still going to screw up. That's why we have harbor pilots.
So the harbor pilot takes over from the ship's captain, but the captain can intercede if he deems it necessary.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the point. I was explaining this again the other day to the folks at the library, that when it came down to who was ultimately to blame for this, and I don't know if we're getting here prematurely, but the master of a ship is actually obligated to take control back from the pilot if he fears that something is not being done correctly, or if he senses his vessel is in trouble, it is his obligation to take it back from the pilot. And that's ultimately what cost the shipping company, why they had to pay for this, because the captain didn't do that. And if you ask me, I'll tell you why. But anyway,
we will ask you.
Yeah,
why
I don't want to jump the gun here.
Yeah. So before we get to more, would you talk about the case of making the bridge four lanes, and why they did that, and other cost-cutting measures that were taken to complete this bridge?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, the Sunshine Skyway Bridge that was opened in 1954 was two lanes. No median, just two lanes. Just
that must have really been scary in two lanes.
Oh. I remember. I was born 4 years after it went up. I remember it only too well, from the back seat of my dad's car, and, you know, hiding in the back seat, because you were almost in the clouds, and these cars are whizzing by you on the other side. At any rate, I guess in 1954, that's okay for what's going on. It's the post-war years, and people are really starting to flood into Florida. But things start to change when you get into the early 60s. There's a lot more people. And most importantly, I think, is the face of tourism was about to suddenly go 180 degrees. Walt Disney World was coming.
Right.
And Governor Burns, Hayden Burns, who was the governor of Florida at the time, was figuratively in bed with Walt Disney. And he was helped broker the deal that they bought all that land up there around Orlando. Hayden Burns, of course, sees the necessity for improving the road system in Florida, and this includes the interstate highway system, which, as you know, had been begun back in the 50s. Now, this two-lane Skyway Bridge, which is really the main artery on the east coast of Florida, is not going to come up to interstate standards. So he has a choice. You can either tear it down and build a four-lane bridge. Bear in mind, it's already more than 10 years old. Or, hey, here's a great idea. Let's build another one. So they went back to the 1950s blueprints, and they just built a twin right next to it. Now, what they did, they cut quite a few corners because it had to get put up fast. It wasn't going to be up to interstate standards until it had four lanes. So we got to do this fast. As Governor Graham explained to me, there's a certain window of time for which you are entitled to receiving federal funding if you get these roads built. After that window closes, you don't get the money anymore. And it really had, all of this had to do with money. You know, from the word go, they put this bridge up, they used what they call bottom boring data from the 50s. In other words, the pilings that were sunk into the bedrock in Tampa Bay, they were sunk using data from the 50s in a different place. Well, the bedrock wasn't the same there. So they had one of the main piers tilted. You lost 2 or 3 years out of construction while they spent $3 million to fix it. It was an accident waiting to happen. This bridge was constructed too quickly and too cheaply.
And we're going to even bring in Governor Graham in a bit. But we're speaking with Bill DeYoung. He's a journalist, editor, and author. And he's written Skyway, the true story of Tampa Bay's signature bridge and the man who brought it down, which occurred 36 years ago. A short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Bill DeYoung. He's an editor and journalist. He's the author of the book Skyway, the true story of Tampa Bay's signature bridge and the man who brought it down. Bill DeYoung, tell us a little bit about the weather and why the National Weather Service wasn't aware that this squally storm was going to hit in that area.
I don't think anybody really knows why the National Weather Service wasn't aware of it. If you look at the patterns, they issued weather advisories every I think 2 to 4 hours in those days, and the last one, which had been issued at 6 a.m., basically said it's windy, there's scattered showers, be careful, folks. Essentially, there's nothing like this monster is coming your way. I'm not sure. I think maybe it formed very quickly as well. It ended up being what they call a macroburst, which is kind of like a miniature windstorm that develops inside of a squall, and it's highly localized. It was just this confluence of bad things all happened at once when the ship was less than a mile from the bridge, and there was no way they could have seen it coming. They had no warnings.
Well, take us through it. Take us through to 7:33 a.m. on May 9th, 1980.
Well, Captain Laro, who's a harbor pilot, was taking some adventure, 606 feet, as you said, 20,000 tons. It was riding light. They were going in to pick up crushed phosphate, and it's about 40 miles from the Gulf of Mexico to the port of Tampa. John used to call it 40 miles of bad road, according to the old Duane Eddy song. And the transit was fairly normal. It was a little gusty. You know, they were wary that there were winds. The rain was intermittent. It wasn't heavy. And it was about 7:15 when everything just exploded. The sky went black. The wind started blowing horizontally from one direction and then to the other. The motorists on the highway, on the Skyway, reported this too. The people whose depositions I have said they remember that the wind would blow one way and then the other, and the rain was blowing horizontally. And this happened in the course of 2 minutes. Everything changed. They know they're approaching the bridge. John is weighing his options. Can I go hard port? Can I turn this thing around in the channel? Well, he couldn't do that because he knew there was an oil tanker called Pure Oil, which had left Port of Tampa and was on its way out the other way. And if he couldn't see it, and if he miscalculated, they would explode. You can't do that. That's not good. Can I take it to the right? Can I take it off the starboard and just ground it in the mud over here? Well, I could do that, except I'm riding really light. I got 50 feet of freeboard out of the water. If I don't ground, this wind, which is coming from the south-southwest, is going to blow me straight into the Skyway Bridge. Now, it takes a mile for ships like this to stop when they're given the order to stop. So he's trying to figure out what to do when the radar goes out. He can't see the bridge. He can't see the turn buoys. He can't see anything. He does not hear the call from the oil tanker saying, I'm still on the other side of the bridge. I've put myself in the mud. It's too dangerous. I don't know where you are. There's some conjecture as to whether or not the pilot of that ship actually made that call. That's also in the book. But he always claimed that he did. So John knew he had no choice then but to plow ahead, literally plow ahead. For one sweep of the radar, the turn buoy he needed came up. And his co-pilot said, it's all right, you're in the right place. You should start your turn right now. There was an awkward dogleg turn you had to make to go under the bridge, under the opening. So John does that. But, of course, what happens then? The wind shifts direction. And as he's making this turn, it starts blowing him south. So he was not going into the gap under the bridge. Clipped one of the support piers. It was called 2S. Not the big one, but the next one down. Just clipped it about 50 feet over the water line. And just about 1,300 feet of bridge came down. And you know the rest.
Well, and it came down not with a bang, but with a whimper.
with a whimper. John talked about, and Bruce told me this too.
You're talking about Bruce Atkins, the co-pilot.
Bruce Atkins, yeah. I spent 3 days with Bruce in Massachusetts, literally going over this, you know, beat by beat, what happened. And the concrete, they said, was just like flying off, like John described it as cornflakes pouring out of a box. It just fell apart. The whole thing fell apart, and it groaned, and it whined, and the whole erector set top of it just collapsed into the water, just fell over eastward and went straight down. And, you know, forensically, you know, Wes McIntyre's car went down with the bridge, and as I said, he slammed into the side, and then the other vehicles followed.
Well, let's listen to the Mayday call that John Larrow makes to the Coast Guard.
Mayday, 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 Coast Guard, Mayday, 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 Coast Guard.
Vessel calling, Mayday, vessel in distress. This is United States Coast Guard, St. Petersburg, Florida. Request your position, nature of distress, and number of persons on board. Over.
This is it. All the emergency. All the emergency equipment out to the Skyway Bridge. Vessel just hit the Skyway Bridge. The Skyway Bridge is down. Get all emergency equipment out to the Skyway Bridge. The Skyway Bridge is down. There's a Mayday. Emergency situation. Stop the traffic on that Skyway Bridge.
This is Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, what size is the vessel that hit the bridge? Over.
The large vessel. Stop the traffic on the Skyway Bridge. There are some people in the water. Get emergency equipment out to the Skyway Bridge now.
This is Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, what vessel are you on? Over.
Some adventure.
Adventure, Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, what is the size of your vessel and can you assist? Over.
Like the size matters.
Like the size matters. This guy is, I get so frustrated listening to this, and I've listened to it quite a bit. Why is he asking these ridiculous questions when he keeps saying the Skyway Bridge is down, stop all traffic on the Skyway Bridge? Was he ever held responsible, this Coast Guard official?
No, not at all. I think that what you have to remember, bearing in mind the time and the location, nothing like this had ever happened here. St. Petersburg is a very quiet town. You know, Tampa's a little faster, but I don't think they'd ever had a tragedy like this either. Nobody could believe this happened. I think what you're hearing with the Coast Guard responder there is, what? And he's asking all the questions that he's supposed to ask. Now, Bruce said, the most helpless feeling in the world he's ever experienced, and I don't think it will ever change, is standing there in the wheelhouse of some adventure. Now, he's 500 feet from the broken bridge. He's 50 feet up in the air on the very top of the superstructure there, watching these cars one by one fall off the edge and fall 150 feet. They can't hear anything. They obviously can't help. They can't do anything. And this guy is saying, you know, how big are you? How many people are on your ship?
And what's the name of it again? What's
yeah,
the name
exactly.
of that ship
so
again?
So it's like, you know, wait, just stop the traffic. Stop the cars from coming. You know, that was all they could do. And he said, I can't even explain that helpless feeling. You know, and then they watched, obviously, the Greyhound bus, which was the last vehicle to go off. And then they saw the big yellow Buick, which was the first one to stop, which I'm sure you're going to ask me about. and Bruce said, and I think John said this in an interview I read, too. Bruce said, we saw the lights coming. Oh, God, here comes another one. They just watched the bus go over. And they're watching that because the headlights are on because it's still pretty drizzly there. Although the rain was already abating somewhat and because it would come and go, you know. But they saw the headlights come up. Oh, God, here comes another one. And Bruce said that the feeling of relief when we saw that car stop and the four doors open and those guys get out.
Little did they know they'd go back.
The driver of that car kind of became a local celebrity in the aftermath of this.
Well, I'm sure Dick Hornbuckle wishes, again, it was for different circumstances.
But right.
Yeah, he did because he was a used car dealer, pretty sharp guy. And when they all got, the four of them, he and his four cronies, four people in the car, his three cronies, they sort of crawled up the grating and back up to safety. But the three guys turn around and Dick is back at his car, 14 inches from the edge, closing the doors. And what he said later was, you know, this is my favorite car. I don't want the wind to take this over the edge. Okay, they watch him do that. Instead of walking back, he's got his keys out and he's opening the trunk of his car. The wind is still howling. They're up there. They're terrified. This horrible thing has happened. You know, they're on the edge of nowhere and there are people on the other bridge stopping and shouting over, you better get out of there. The whole thing's going to come crashing down. Dick is opening his trunk to get his golf clubs out. because he loved his golf clubs. And he had a game the next day. And he said, what he said later was, well, I knew some insurance company would end up taking care of the car, but golf clubs, those are like a good old trustworthy pair of shoes.
Well,
they talked him out of it. He didn't do it. And, and the car sat in his driveway until the day he died in the year 2000. Mm. He kept that car.
That's Dick Hornbuckle. Right.
Hornbuckle. Paul G. Hornbuckle.
Okay.
That's another thing you'd read. Like, his name is Paul Hornbuckle. Everybody always called him Dick, and I spoke to several members of his family, and nobody could remember why Dick was his nickname, Dickie. He went to Florida Bible College in the same class as Billy Graham. I found out all kinds of interesting stuff. But what you'd also find out in reporting and the coverage of this incident was that they always called him Richard. Richard Hornbuckle wasn't his name at all, and that was the sort of thing that I was talking about before, how, what's the real deal with these people? And I was very interested, as I said, in the human side of what happened.
We're speaking with Bill DeYoung, journalist, editor, and author. His book is Skyway, the true story of Tampa Bay's signature bridge and the man who brought it down.
Bill, we're going to delay our break a little bit. We have Senator Bob Graham on the line. Of course, he was governor during the 1980 May Day when the Skyway Bridge went down over Tampa Bay. Welcome to you, Senator Bob Graham. Let me put him up.
Yeah.
There he is. Senator Graham, you with us?
I did not realize until you noted it that this is the anniversary day of the collapse of the Sunshine Skyway Bridge.
36 years.
Very, very significant event in Florida history.
Well, tell us your view of it. And you were there very quickly.
Yes. 1980 was a year filled with crises in Florida. When the ship went down, I was on a plane flying from Tallahassee to Key West because of the Mario boat lift, which was going on at the time. I was shocked at what had happened. Contacted from the air our emergency response people, and they cooperated with the local law enforcement and emergency folks, and to the extent possible contained the extent of the loss of life. And then a few days later, we started with the question of what do we do now?
And what did you do from a state standpoint?
Well, there were two choices. One was to rebuild the rebuild the Sunshine Skyway Bridge in the same configuration that it had been before the collapse. That was a bridge that was started in the 1950s. It had been doubled in size, initially being a two-lane, now a four-lane highway. But it was already showing a lot of the maintenance issues of any steel bridge over a saltwater area. So one choice was to patch it up, put it back in service as quickly as possible. The other approach was that we're going to have to do major renovation of this bridge in the very near future. Why don't we use this tragedy as the time to do that and build a bridge which will be both safer for motorist and maritime use, will be a modern bridge, concrete rather than steel, and will hopefully become the point of identification of the Tampa Bay area in the same way that the Golden Gate Bridge is for San Francisco. And I believe all of those objectives were accomplished with the new bridge that was constructed in the place of the one that had fallen.
Senator, before the Skyway Bridges collapsed, the Department of Transportation said that it was in very poor shape. Were you aware of that or any of the people in your administration?
Yes, we were aware that it was approaching the end of its useful life and would require significant rehabilitation. And there was another economic factor. We were getting towards the end of the authorization of the interstate highway system. That bridge is part of the interstate highway system. And if the repair or new structure was started while still in that window of opportunity, the federal government would pick up a substantial share, 70% to 90% of the cost. If we got out of that time period, then it would be a full state responsibility to finance whatever solution was selected to replace the collapsed bridge.
Senator, I was just wondering, in retrospect, was it ever believed that the bridge would have crumbled from the hit by the Summit Venture if it hadn't been built hastily, that southern span?
I don't know. I frankly can't say whether there was any specific discussion of the relative vulnerabilities of different parts of the Sunshine Skyway Bridge. I just know the macro evaluation was that it was in bad shape and was going to take significant amount of expensive rehabilitation in the rather immediate future.
Bill DeYoung, do you have any questions for Senator Bob Graham?
Well, it's just nice to hear your voice again, Senator. And I think that it's important to point out for everyone out there that the bridge that went up in 1987 and it's still standing and is pretty glorious is called the Bob Graham Sunshine Skyway Bridge,
right. Mm-hmm.
Having been named for your guest here. And that's about all I can
say. It's really such a structural marvel.
It's a beautiful bridge.
I agree. And it was one of the first in North America of what's called cable stay construction, which had become prevalent in Europe, but was still thought of as experimental in our country. I will say that now, almost 30 years later, that the bridge has performed superbly and has been that signature for the Tampa Bay region.
And many safety measures were taken when the bridge in 87 was built that made it very different from the original Skyway, correct?
Yes. For maritime, the window, that rectangle below the centerpiece of the bridge, was made higher and wider so that it could accommodate the larger and larger ships that were coming in to Tampa Bay with a margin of error. And then for motorists, it became a multi-lane bridge with greater opportunities to avoid accidents or have disabled vehicles not themselves become the cause of a future accidents.
Well, Senator Bob Graham, I know we have a narrow window that you can participate, so we're going to say goodbye to you. Thank you very much for coming on. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. DeYoung, for the book that you have written. It'll be an important addition to the Library of Florida History.
Thank you, sir. I'm very, very proud to hear you say that. Thank you.
Senator Bob Graham, of course, he was governor at the time in 1980 when the Skyway Bridge was hit and destroyed. Back to our guest editor and journalist, Bill DeYoung. We're talking about his book, Skyway, The True Story of Tampa Bay's Signature Bridge and the Man Who Brought It Down. Speaking of the man who brought it down, let's talk about John Laro. He was sort of an outcast. He belonged to a very clannish association that resented his very employment.
The harbor pilots of Tampa Bay, the harbor pilots of Florida, had been traditionally, historically hired from within. In other words, we take care of our own. We bring people up. Generally, they were tug pilots who, you know, had traversed the bay and really knew what they had to do. They were ended up being sons and grandsons and uncles and cousins. So what happens is 1975, before Governor Graham was in office, as a matter of fact, just before, the Department of professional regulation starts a pilot commission in Florida. They start mandating that they will hire pilots and assign them to the various ports. Didn't sit well with the local pilot groups. You can imagine the very first person hired under this new law, which wasn't any nepotism law, was John Laro. Mm. And he was sent to Tampa. And so he essentially walked into a hornet's nest of people that were already looking to not like him.
But this wasn't the first time that Laro had struck the bridge.
Well, yeah, it's interesting when you, again, people tend to remember that. I have a whole bunch of network news broadcasts, and Jane Pauley has this big revelation from Tampa Bay that this guy had hit the bridge once before. He hit the bridge once before when the stern of a ship he was piloting around a wreck, which is the Coast Guard cutter Blackthorn, which is another story.
Right.
Basically, the stern swung out and clipped in a fairly minor way. One of the support piers. He was praised by the Board of Pilot Commissioners for not causing more serious damage, for avoiding a catastrophe. The pilots at that period were being forced to take a much more narrow channel, and he kind of missed. What they don't talk about, what Jane Pauley didn't talk about in those days, and people don't remember, is that he had one of the best records on the pilot board in Tampa. He'd been under that bridge back and forth more than 800 times. There were at least three other guys who had much worse records. They clipped it all the time. All the time.
Now, he was blamed. He was vilified for this accident. And from reading your account and from listening to everything that happened, it doesn't sound as though it was preventable, nor could he have done anything differently. Now, I know you didn't write this book to exonerate him. He was exonerated.
Yeah.
But do you think that anything could have been done differently?
I think that we should ask ourselves why the Florida government of 1954 never put any protection up. When you look at the photos of the earliest photos of the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, there were these sort of 2x4, I don't know what you call them, under bridges, where they're just 2x4s and pilings, sort of like a funnel to take a, you know, what's that going to do? And that's what was in existence from day one. They never protected this. There was a former engineer with DOT, Arthur Goodale, who worked on the early bridge and kind of was the whistleblower on all of this when it happened with the second bridge. And he called the Sunshine Skyway, since day one, an accident waiting to happen. Mm. It was just a matter of time before something like this happened. It's terrible to think of now how many times all of us in Florida went over that bridge, both spans of it, taking our lives in our own hands.
I was wondering if, in light of the dangers of the bridge and in light of what happened, were the bridge builders, the architects, were any of them ever brought to answer questions or to account for this?
No. I mean, you can listen. I've explained this a lot, too, because I get that question a lot. If you take 20,000 moving tons and give a lateral strike to any kind of concrete, whether it's the strongest concrete in the world, it's going to collapse. So, no, it was kind of a moot point by then. Yeah, the bridge was in bad shape, but nothing had ever hit in that place before. They were just lucky it had never happened. Corners were cut, but I don't think that really contributed.
Okay.
You know, Bruce Atkins has this feeling, you know, he's one of those people who says, well, you know, it was obviously badly. I mean, you should have seen the way it fell apart. But no, nothing ever came of that. I mean, the tragedy was there in front of it, laid at everybody's feet. And finger-pointing started and stopped at John Laro.
We're speaking with journalist, editor, and author Bill DeYoung about his book Skyway, The True Story of Tampa Bay's Signature Bridge and the Man Who Brought It Down. A short break. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Bill DeYoung. We're talking about his book Skyway, The True Story of Tampa Bay's Signature Bridge and the Man Who Brought It Down. Well, let's go to the coda of this, which is really quite drawn out, but sort of the demise of John Laro.
Well, things went from bad to worse for John. One of the low points for him that I discovered was when the Department of Professional Regulation and the Board of Pilot Commissioners turned on him. There was so much heat from every direction, and it was all aimed towards the pilots. How can this guy, you know, whether he was drunk, whether he was this, whether he was that, we've established he wasn't any of those things. How can anybody in their right mind hit a stationary object that big, you know? I've forgotten what the question was. I was going off on a tangent.
We were just saying his downfall.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry.
The medical side, the mental side.
So John really took it from all sides. Yeah, and what happens is, but they turned on him, and the head of the department came out and said in the media, in effect, we regret hiring this guy. He's obviously irresponsible. Mm. They revoked his license, which he had to fight to get back. The Coast Guard report comes out and said that while he probably could have made a more prudent decision, there was really nothing he could have done. So he was exonerated, and eventually they were forced to give him his license back through a confluence of good things that happened. And John thought, oh, wow, I can actually do this again. Meanwhile, his wife has left him. So there's that. But he gets his license back. Within 6 months, he starts to notice some funny stuff in his legs and his hands, and he goes to the doctor. He's diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, which he had to read up about, as did I. Now, MS is a degenerative muscle disease, as you know. He had no history of it in his family, but what he read and what I read and what you all can read is that stress is frequently a trigger. Intense stress will trigger something that's lying dormant in you. And that was pretty much all he'd known for 2 years. With stress. Not long after that, he has to give up his license because he can't climb those pilot ladders up the sides of ships anymore. He can't climb up the narrow stairways in those big vessels anymore. He has to give that up. So he spent, well, what turned out to be the final 16, 17 years of his life roaming around trying to find some way to feel normal again,
well,
to fit in.
Well, he went back to school and
he went back to the SUNY Maritime College. He went back to the Maritime College very briefly, and he taught basic seamanship for a semester. I've been up there and kind of roamed around and went on the ship and looked at everything. Kind of spooky and sad to do this so many years after John's been gone. It was successful, but his MS was getting worse. He was literally walking with a cane, dragging his leg, and, you know, had the shakes, and it was, people were, you know, the students were pointing at him, and so he finally gave that up. He comes back here. There was a very brief attempt to make a film to capitalize on this, which he kind of felt bad about, but decided, well, I guess I need the money. That fell through for various reasons, and then, yes, he went back to the University of South Florida and got a degree in counseling. He became a counselor, a crisis counselor. Mm-hmm. And there, it's all kind of documented in the book. And his feeling was that anybody who calls me, you know, I know what like a mental crisis is. I you know, I know what fear and helplessness feels like. I can talk to these people. Never made it. He never made it to become a counselor. The disease finally took over, and he was physically incapacitated. And he spent his last years as a guilt-plagued invalid. Very, very sad.
Most people, when they think of a harbor pilot, would think of kind of a big, tough, grizzly guy. But he was very highly educated. He painted. He collected art. He loved classical music.
Well, he was a fast-talking New Yorker, too. And when you put those guys, I'm not going to do the voice anymore, thanks, but when you put those
that wasn't
guys,
bad.
Yeah, when you do those guys, you put them together with these kind of drawling southern old good old boy tugboat guys. You know, he was like a fish out of water in a lot of ways down here.
He did have his son, though.
Yeah.
And were you able to speak with his son for the book?
Yes, yes, I was. It took a while to get Charles to trust me. The family is still all these years later very sensitive to the vilification thing, and why do you really want to talk about this, Bill? You know, Charles lives in Oregon now, and he visited Tampa. We spent an afternoon together here. We talked on the phone a lot, emailed quite a bit when I had a question. I said, "What about this?" It took a little while, but he was very close to his dad, particularly in that last. After the divorce, he lived with his dad, so probably the last 20 years they got to be very close. And I spoke with John's only sibling, a sister who lives in Italy. So that's how I learned about their early days up in Queens, where he grew up.
Of course, with an event like this, Lawsuits can kind of come out of the woodwork. What were the civil lawsuits that this caused? I know the bus company was sued.
Oh, my gosh. At one point, there were 42 law firms involved. It was literally a cottage industry for a while. The survivor's family sued Greyhound. Greyhound sued the state of Florida. The state of Florida sued itself at one point. The state of Florida sued the ship owners. The ship owners sued the state of Florida. Nobody sued Laro, but he was, as I say, he was exonerated. There were never any criminal charges filed, which he was very grateful about. Ultimately, the end result is that the ship owners, a company called Wakwong Shipping out of Hong Kong, which owned the ship and hired the crew, they were found liable for this because, as we said in the beginning, the captain did not exercise his his right and his obligation, really, to take over when he suspected something was wrong.
And why didn't he?
Well, according to his testimony, Captain Liu said, I feel like the pilot's in charge and I didn't want to make things worse for him. What it came out was that Wakwong had a policy. They never told the people who work for them that you are obligated. You're still in control of this ship. And I think it's a little thin, but somebody had to sort of take the blame in the end. They had to pay the state of Florida for the bridge, for the repairs, for the cleanup, and they paid restitution, if that's the word, to victims' families to the tune of somewhere around $400,000.
Where's the Summit Venture today?
Summit Venture sank in December 2010 off the coast of Vietnam. It had been bought, sold, the way these things are. I mean, remember, it was built in 76, so it was already pretty old by the time this happened. And it's bought, sold, renamed, and it was working over in Southeast Asia. I believe the story it was hauling, the story is that it was hauling a load of nickel ore, very heavy, from one place to another, and got 60-foot seas, boom, sank. Rescued the whole crew, but they left it there. It's still there.
How about the reaction of the city of Tampa or its residents, many of them anyway? Did they really need to have sort of a villain and Laro became it just because it was so unexplainable of why this happened?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, isn't that why you have scapegoats? I think I saw this on a Twilight Zone episode the other day. If you can't explain it, just look around and point at somebody. He was the obvious one, and what I regret, well, for John and historically more than anything else, is the fact that people remember him and they remember those initial moments of finger pointing and the terrible things that were said about him. But as we said before, they don't remember that it really wasn't his fault, that he was exonerated.
Well, I'm glad you wrote this book because...
Thank you.
Yeah, because if it wasn't publicized and his exoneration wasn't nearly as, it's still, Michael this morning, that was the guy that just rammed it into the bridge.
Sure.
I mean, at least now the truth is out. And one other question which I'm very happy for him and, his legacy, but one other question that kind of had me a little puzzled is when this happened, they left it in place, this mangled, mess in place and used the other side for the two-way traffic until they...
That was spooky. That was a spooky drive.
Yeah, what was that like? Yeah. Why did they leave it there? I mean, why it was like, why would you leave that there? It evoked such bad memories.
Well, I can come all the way around again to saying what I said before. This all had to do with money. They didn't really need to build this bridge in the first place, I don't think. But it was a matter of getting more people. You should have seen the newspapers, the advertising supplements when this opened. The vacation paradise in Manatee County, Sarasota County, this was all about bringing more people and more money to this area. Mm-hmm. I think they left that span up there because it cost a lot of money to tear it down.
Yeah,
they had to have that's the best I can do, really. it's rather incomprehensible, but if you look at the state of Florida, they did things when it was time to do them.
Right.
Well
it's been
enough.
A pleasure. Bill DeYoung, journalist, editor, author. He
Thank
is
you so much.
Nationally recognized for his music journalism, which we didn't get to, but he's written Skyway, the true story of Tampa Bay's signature bridge and the man who brought it down. Bill DeYoung, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. And there's a memorial there, by the way. We put up a year ago on the 35th anniversary. There's a granite statue that you might want to come by and see sometime that with all the victims' names on it.
That was largely from your efforts, wasn't it?
Well, I sort of spearheaded it. The community paid for it, but we were very glad to do that last year. Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Our program about the Skyway Bridge disaster was recorded in May of 2016. Today's technical direction was by Jason Zapka, who is our online producer. Our lead producer is Richard Ives, and Polly Landis is associate producer. Don't forget about the free audio archives of each edition, available at our website, WLRN.org. More information, pics, and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. There's also an iTunes Topical Currents podcast. Thursday's program begins with a look at Special Olympics of Florida and their torch event scheduled next month. There'll be one near you. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining with wine columnist Fred Tasker. Bonnie Berman for Joseph Cooper. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.